Good morning. This is Ren again, Ren to Wheel, your friendly local neighborhood Palestinian American, recording this non-live recorded program from Santa Cruz, California. This program is intended for broadcast on Free Radio Santa Cruz, which broadcasts from, which broadcasts on 101.3 on the FM dial, and we're streaming live online at freakradio.org. That's freak as in F-R-E-A-K, radio.org. Free Radio has been without its own studio space since the last week of September of this year, 2015. We were forced to move out of that physical location, and I just want to assure everyone that at the moment we're looking at a property that we have high hopes for. I don't want to go so far even as to say that it looks good, but be assured that we're looking seriously at a space, at a piece of real estate in Santa Cruz, which we hope to be broadcasting from in the near future. Even if that doesn't work out, I assure you we will continue to keep our eyes open and search diligently for a future studio space for Free Radio Santa Cruz. So here it is, let's see, 2.5 months after we were forced to leave the old location, and finally I'm in a position where I, Ren to Wheel, can produce episodes of Mideast Migraines. This program is intended for broadcast on Saturday, December 12, at 11 a.m. Saturday, which is the normal and scheduled time slot for the weekend edition of Mideast Migraines, always coming to you at 11 a.m. on Saturday, and its sister program, if you will, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon every Monday. So we have 11 a.m. Saturdays, 3 p.m. Mondays. Welcome and hello, and I'm sure you're all just tickled pink to hear my voice again. Again, not a live program because I'm actually recording this from my own home PC. Since we do not have a studio yet, that makes sense, doesn't it? If we don't have a storefront type location that we can broadcast from, I have to do it on my own. I've figured it out with the help of other Vital Collective members. You may recall the faithful former listeners, or listeners of former Saturday editions, that the Saturday editions of the edition of Mideast Migraines. Let's see. Broadcasting on Saturday. Are dedicated to the readings of important, recent, or reasonably recent books, basically whole books, on the topic of peace between Israelis and Palestinians. The conflict between Israel and various Arab nationalities and groups remains quite fundamental to the search for peace in the Middle East. You can talk about ISIS all you want, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or what's happening in the civil war in Syria. Those are problems that are unique upon themselves, but between Palestinian and Arabs and primarily Israeli Jews is its own ongoing topic of discussion. And so Saturday editions of Mideast Migraines remains dedicated to the readings of books. The next selection of pertinent, fairly recently published books that will be read on this program starting next Saturday, that would be, let me see, the 19th, Saturday the 19th of December, is entitled The General's Son, An Israeli's Journey into Palestine. I don't have the book in front of me, but I'm pretty sure that is the formal title. The General's Son, An Israeli's Journey into Palestine. The author is Miko Pellet. The title, The General's Son, refers to the fact that Miko is the son of Mati Peled, the late Mati Peled, who was a hero in the Israeli Defense Forces, as Israel, of course, prefers to call their military army in various other branches. General Mati Peled was a hero in the 1967 war, a hero certainly to the Israelis, who fought an aggressive war against Egypt and Jordan and Syria in 1967 again. And the general, who was a staunch Zionist and militarist for the state of Israel, after that war, very soon after the 1967 conflict, came to become a pacifist. Now, that is a story unto itself, and I will get into that in the form of his son Miko's writings of the book that I'll begin reading a week from today. I want to preface the reading of Miko Pellet's book with a lecture by him, and I will allow him to give certain identifying characteristics to that talk in the course of his of the lecture. And I will, you see, I have played this lecture a couple of times before on this program, but I thought it would be a good idea to hear the words of the author himself. Again, he's not going to be reading from his book in the course of this talk, but he will be giving a lecture. And the two times that I've aired this before, I failed to provide the complete speech. We ran out of time. It seems to me we were some 12 minutes late. So let's just go ahead and play that talk in its entirety, and then I'll return. Here is Miko Pellet. This is available on YouTube. Again, details in the course of his talk, and I will fill in the blank spaces at the end of his speech. Talk to you later. Here's Miko Pellet.
This is a beautiful church, so once again, thank you to the pastor for allowing us to use this. This is really beautiful, and thank you all for being here tonight and for caring enough to take the time and listen and participate and be active. I always begin my remarks with a disclaimer, and that disclaimer is this. If anybody here came hoping to hear a balanced presentation, then they're going to be sorely disappointed. I say this because a lot of things that you're about to hear tonight are difficult to hear. And also because I don't believe that a balanced presentation on this topic is possible. Anybody that cares enough to speak about this probably has a very strong opinion one way or the other. Almost everybody has feelings and strong emotions on this issue one way or the other. For me, it's deeply personal. And the issue itself is not a balanced issue. There is no balance in this issue. So therefore, I say this is there cannot be a balanced presentation on this. And I think if anybody claims that their presentation is balanced, they're either misleading themselves or they're misleading their audience. This whole issue of Israel and Palestine is covered in so much myth. And there's so much double standard when people talk about this issue. And I'll give you two examples. I don't know if you heard Bibi Netanyahu's speech at the United Nations. I heard it, not live, but after he actually delivered it. And he began it with probably the two most striking examples of myth and double standard. And he began by talking about the right of return of the Jews to their ancient homeland. And of course, the Jews that returned, so-called returned to their homeland, were not exactly the same Jews who were expelled from their homeland, right? Because these were expelled a couple of thousand years before that. These were not their descendants either, because this has been a very long time. So these are people, the people that actually came back, so to speak, are people that claim some kind of a heritage, some kind of a connection, a relationship to the ancient Hebrews. And they claimed that they had the right to return to their homeland, and this is what Zionism was about, and this was you know, accepted by the world as the right. They had the right to return. Now, if we talk about the right of return of one nation, you'd expect that there would be, if we accept it as a principle, then you'd expect that we'd accept it in general, across the board. Yet when people talk about the right of return of Palestinians to their homeland, suddenly a red line comes up and everybody says, no, we can't talk about the right of return of the Palestinians. This has to be taken off the table. This is not negotiable. The right of return of the Palestinians is not acceptable. What's interesting about that is that the right of return of the Palestinians, quite often we talk about the actual people who had to leave their homes. And if they had already passed away, then we're talking about their direct descendants, people who still have the keys and the deeds to their homes, and quite often can go to the very spot where a village existed, where today there might be a highway, and will point out the mosque, and will point out the well, and will point out the door to their home. Yet they do not enjoy the right to return. So obviously, this is a double standard of immense proportions. The other thing BB talked about right off as he started was about King David, who reigned some 3,000 years ago, and here we are today as his descendants. What's interesting is, besides the fact that there is no historical evidence that King David ever existed, outside the Bible, which of course is not a historical document, and Israeli archaeologists have all but turned up the entire country to find proof that he ever existed. Today, as we speak, an entire town, an entire community is being kicked out of their homes and forced into exile through violence in order to prove that King David existed in a place called Silwan. It's a community of 50,000 people right outside the walls of the old city of Jerusalem. Yet the world sees nothing wrong with this. American money is poured into this project to build what is called the New City of David, an archaeological park. And a community of 50,000 Palestinians has to be terrorized in order to leave. Their homes are being destroyed in order to make this point, this fictional, mythical connection between the ancient kingdom of King David and today's Israel. So these are just two examples. And it was interesting that Bibi Netanyahu decided to kick off his speech at the United Nations with these two things. But what I'd like to do today is just begin with a little bit of history. And if you go ahead, hit the first slide. Thank you. People talk about the fact that this conflict, the conflict in the Holy Land, the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians has been around for so long that it's really not something anybody can ever solve. It's been going on for thousands of years. People have been killing each other there forever. This is not true. And a good place to start, if we're going to talk about how this conflict began, a good place to start would be on the 29th of November, 1947, the day the United Nations accepted the resolution to partition Palestine into a Jewish state and an Arab state. And this ridiculous map is what they came up with. Now, when you look at this map, before you even hear about the details, before we even touch on the details of this map, just by looking at it, it's unbelievable that anybody expected that this would work. And of course, this didn't even last one day. In 1947, there were two communities living parallel lives. We had the Jewish community that numbered about 500,000, maybe a little bit less than 500,000, that were expecting and hoping to become a state. And you had the Arab community, the Palestinian Arab community, of about 1.5 million people who were also in the process and had the expectation of becoming a state. Yet when the United Nations came up with this ridiculous plan, they chose to give the larger portion of the country to the smaller community, to the Jewish community. And the smaller portion of the land to the larger community. And then people said, and to this day you hear people say, see, the Arabs, the Palestinians, did not accept the partition plan, so all this is their fault. Is anybody mad enough to think that they would accept this? Would anybody in their Palestinian, in their place, have accepted something like this? Obviously not. And obviously, like I said, this did not last even a single day. Because as soon as the resolution was accepted, the Zionist forces, what was called the Haganah, the Palmach, began a massive campaign of ethnic cleansing. Now the story that we hear, the myth that we're told about 1947, and I heard it once again today, earlier today, at the Seattle Times, is that in 1947, after the United Nations finally recognized the right of the Jewish people to have their own state, the Arab armies attacked, intending to destroy this fledgling state, this young Jewish community. And this is only several years after the Nazi Holocaust. Yet somehow, between the end of 1947 and the end of 1948, the Zionist forces were able to conquer almost 80% of the country, destroy over 500 towns and villages, including schools and mosques and churches and homes, and exile almost 1 million people within a 12-month period. How did they do this if they were being attacked by massive armies from the outside? But once again, when we look at the facts, we realize that in 1947, the Jewish community, the Zionist community, had quite a substantial military force. They had a force of close to 40,000 armed men, and well-trained, well-indoctrinated. My father was one of them. There was no equivalent on the Palestinian side. The Palestinians have never had a military force. To this day, the Palestinians have never had an army or a military force. There was no equivalent of the other side. The Arab armies, such as they were, didn't enter the war until late in May of 1948. Much of the ethnic cleansing had already taken place. The war had been taking place for over 6 months by then. So, of course, this is a myth. This is a myth that nobody takes the time to investigate and question. But once again, the reality that in a 12-month period, so much was done, exactly because that is exactly what was the purpose of these Zionist forces. To capture as much of the land as possible and get rid of as many people as possible. And that's exactly what they did. Would you hit the next one, please? You heard the story, Judith related to the story about my mother. That's my mother. She's 86 now. She's still living in Jerusalem. She was born and raised in Jerusalem. And she used to tell me how when she was young, she would walk around on a Saturday afternoon. And many of the beautiful neighborhoods in Jerusalem, and I'm talking about the New Jerusalem, the Jerusalem that was built outside the city walls. These were Palestinian communities with beautiful homes. And she would walk around and she would see the families on a Saturday afternoon sitting under the or by the lemon tree and so on. Yet, and then in 1948, she was living still in Jerusalem. These communities were forced to leave. Their homes were given to Israeli families. And she was offered one of these homes, and like you heard, she refused. The thought of taking another family's home just did not sit well with her. And then she saw the looting, and then she still, to this day, when she talks about it, you can see that she feels such a sense of shame. But what's interesting is that I remember hearing this story as a child many, many years ago and over a very long period of time. And it wasn't until I was actually working on the book and I spoke to her about this again that I realized why this story was bothering me all those years. Because the story was bothering me. There was something about it that was troubling. And only now I realized it was troubling because it contradicted the national narrative. It contradicted what I learned in school. That the Arabs attacked, we won, they left, and we get the spoils. So what's wrong with taking their homes? If this is the truth, then there's no wrong in taking their homes. They attacked, and we won. It's fair enough. But once again, like I said, hearing the story in the back of my mind over and over and over again kind of troubled me. And this is exactly why. The truth lays in the personal story, not in the national narrative. Can you hit the next one, please? The title of the book is The General Son, and then the subtitle is Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. So the General Son is a big part of who I am, and this is my father as a general. Now, after the State of Israel was established and the Jewish militia, the Zionist militia became the Israeli army, he remained as an officer and had a very long and interesting military career. 20 years later, 1967, the drums of war were beating, he was already a general. And a lot has been written about what happened in 1967 and why the war broke out and who actually started the war and why. A lot of books have been written about this, movies have been made about this, and it's an interesting period. Now, just kind of to touch on the history, some of you I'm sure recall, the Egyptian President Nasser decided to kick out the UN peacekeeping forces that were in the Sinai Peninsula that divided Egypt from Israel. And he entered against the ceasefire agreement that existed between the countries. He entered Egyptian troops into the Sinai Peninsula. The general saw this as a cause for war, as a legitimate cause for war. And they pushed for war. The Israeli cabinet, however, they were hesitant. They were not so eager to start a war. And this tug of war began between these two groups. It was a very interesting difference between these two groups, because the cabinet members were older, they were in their late 60s, early 70s, most of them. They were born in exile. They came with this whole baggage of exile, of pogroms, and this is only 25 years after the Holocaust, and they carried all this, and they were worried that a war might lead to another Holocaust. The generals, however, were in their early 40s. Almost all of them were born in Palestine. Almost all of them were members of the Zionist militia before in 1948. And they were what I like to call the new Jew that the Zionists wanted to create. Full of testosterone and very assertive and willing and ready to fight. And they created the Israeli army. Well, they wanted to fight. They saw an opportunity to start another war. Now, the myth that we're told about this, or the story, I should say, that we're told about the 1967 war is that once again, Israel was attacked by three massive armies intending to destroy it. And once again, miraculously, somehow, we, the Israelis, prevailed. Because we're smarter and because we're better trained and we're more motivated and, as we heard now recently, we're somehow culturally superior as well, perhaps. Who knows? But for all these reasons, we prevailed and we defeated the Arab armies. Once again, when I was working on the book, I decided to go into the Israeli army archives to learn about my father's career. Like I said, he had a very, very interesting military career. And I was interested particularly in reading the minutes of the meetings of the generals leading up to the 1967 war. Now, once again, a lot has been written about those meetings. So I wasn't expecting to find anything new, because I'd read everything that was out there. But as soon as I began reading, I saw something that I'd not seen anywhere else. My father says this, and several of the other generals say this, in their attempt to convince the cabinet to start the war. And that is that the Egyptian army is not prepared for war, and therefore we must attack now. In fact, they said the Egyptian army needs at least a year and a half to 2 years before it will be prepared for war. So we have a tremendous opportunity now to once again, this will be the third time, to destroy the Egyptian army. And the fact that the Egyptian army brought their troops into Sinai and closer to us, closer to Israel, only makes it easier for us to destroy them. Not only are they not talking about an existential threat, they're not talking about any threat. They're talking about an opportunity, a military opportunity to once again defeat the Egyptian army. So once again, the myth fizzles away. The generals, of course, won the day. The government Allah gave them the okay to start a preemptive strike against Egypt. The Egyptian army was decimated in a couple of days. The Sinai Peninsula was conquered once again. The Gaza Strip was conquered. And the generals wanted more. The generals wanted more. They wanted the West Bank, which was a sore spot for them because in 1948 they wanted to take it. They were young commanders in 1948 and they wanted the West Bank then. But for political reasons, Israel decided not to take it. Well, here was their opportunity, and they took the West Bank. And they'd wanted the Golan Heights for a long time, too, because it's high up above the Galilee, and it's, you know, there's lots of water there, and they took that as well. And there was a lot of ambition, too. The generals, the northern commander wanted the Golan Heights, the central commander wanted, you know, they all wanted the laurels of victory. They had no doubt that they're going to be victorious. In 6 days, the Israeli army defeated and destroyed three Arab armies, conquered the West Bank, the Golan Heights, the Sinai Peninsula, the Gaza Strip, killed over 15,000 Arab soldiers at a loss of 700 soldiers to the Israeli army. 15,000 to 700, that's quite a ratio. And all this was done in 6 days as Arab armies were attacking them. True. That's another one of those stories that nobody talks about, the USS Liberty, that's right. So again, the myth fizzles away once you actually take a look at the facts. Now, my father did something very interesting. After the war was over, at the very first meeting of the generals, the very first weekly meeting, he stood up and he said, now we have an opportunity to solve the Palestinian question. We can now offer the Palestinians a state in the West Bank and Gaza. If we do this, this will be the first Arab state with which Israel will have a peace agreement. It'll be a bridge for peace agreements with the other Arab countries, since Palestine, of course, was always a central issue. And we can go on living, you know, being the democratic Jewish state that we want it to be. And as he was saying this, a massive settlement project and an ethnic cleansing project began in the West Bank. Hundreds of thousands were thrown out, towns and villages and cities were destroyed, and new towns were being built, and highways, and so on, and infrastructure to bring Israelis into the West Bank. Just as Israel had done after 1948, destroying Palestinian towns and villages, changing the names, and building towns and villages for Israelis, the same thing was done in the West Bank after 1967. For Israel, this meant the job was done. In essence, what they did was they erased Palestine off the map. I always like to show this picture. This is the victory lap. These are all the generals standing after the war, young, you know, victorious. And in the center is Zalman Shazar, who is the president of the state of Israel. You know, Israel has a president as kind of a symbolic figure, somebody who used to be a, you know, something important in his lifetime. And you see the old generation and the new generation. And this new generation of generals is often referred to as the silver tray upon which the land of Israel was given to the Jewish people. Because from that point on, the entire land of Israel was under Jewish control for the first time after 2,000 years and only 25 years after the Holocaust. Historically, from a Zionist perspective, this is unbelievable, unprecedented. But in fact, this is what they did. Palestine was erased completely from the map, and Israel was in completely over the entire map. This was the objective. This was the name of the game. erasing Palestine, getting rid of the people, and de-Arabizing the country. De-Arabizing the country is what was left to do. That's why when people talk about the possibility of Israel somehow giving up the West Bank for a Palestinian state, if it wasn't so sad, it would be funny. It shows a complete misunderstanding of the objective of Zionism and the Jewish state, and the Zionist state. Because conquering the land was the first objective, getting rid of the people, and then de-Arabizing. And when I say de-Arabizing the country, this country has a 1,500-year-old history of Arab and Muslim rule. It was an Arab and a Muslim country more than it was anything else in history. So that has to be destroyed. Monuments have to be destroyed. Names have to be changed. The history has to be rewritten to connect once again King David to today's Israel and completely disregard the fact that this is in fact an Arab country. That it is in fact in the center of the Arab world. And that in fact over half of the population are Arabs. Now, after my father retired from the military, he did something even more stunning. He dedicated the rest of his life to the creation of a Palestinian state and peace with the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. And he advocated for equal rights for the Palestinians who are Israeli citizens. Two things which are yet to be achieved. Now, in the mid-1970s, the Palestinian leadership, the PLO, this started contacting my father and others, or Avneri and others, people who were like that, in order to begin a dialogue. And that is really when the notion of the two-state solution was put together. These were Yasser Arafat's top people, his advisors and his ambassadors and so on. In this picture is my father with Dr. Issam Sartawi, who was the Palestinian ambassador, the PLO ambassador to Paris. He was later killed in 1983. And this dialogue went on between official representatives of the PLO and, on the Israeli side, these were renegades. These are people who used to hold, you know, high office of one kind or another, and they were Zionist Israelis. But the Israeli government refused to take part in any of this. Only in 1993, did the Israeli government agree to finally begin negotiating with the Palestinians? What happened? What changed? Well, what changed was they accomplished their mission of making the conquest of the West Bank irreversible. By 1993, the Israeli government knew for certain that a Palestinian state could not be established in the West Bank. The settlements were there, billions were invested, the entire Jordan River Valley was settled with villages and then kibbutzim and things like that. There were major cities already built in the West Bank. The entire East Jerusalem was taken over by Israel. There was no place anymore for a Palestinian state to be established. And that is when Israel said, okay, we will begin negotiations. So they allowed Arafat to come, misleading him into thinking that they were really intending to make peace and basically trying to force him to sign an agreement that would complete his surrender. But once again, when we hear people still talking about the notion that somehow there could be an Israeli government that would give up the West Bank for a Palestinian state, like I said, if it wasn't so sad and tragic, it would be funny. Because as we look at the 65-year history of the State of Israel, it is absolutely clear that this can never happen. Now, later on in the year 2000, I'm sure you recall, President Clinton invited Barak and Arafat to Camp David to somehow solidify a peace agreement. Or so he said. What they tried to do is force Arafat once again to surrender, which he would not do. So they came out of Camp David, and President Clinton said, Arafat gave some, Barak gave more. In other words, this is Arafat's fault. And from that moment on, for the last 4 years of his life, he was vilified, and eventually Arafat died with Israeli tanks surrounding his office under siege. But the myth that we're always told is that the Palestinians are not willing to make concessions. And that is the problem. I think Mitt Romney just alluded to this as well in that little secret tape that was recorded. The problem is the Palestinians, they just don't want peace. Yasser Arafat was willing to give up almost 80% of his homeland and the right of the Palestinian refugees to return to their homeland and be compensated, all for the sake of peace. What he wouldn't do is he wouldn't go beyond, he wouldn't go, you know, less than 20%. He wouldn't give up the West Bank and the Gaza. That he couldn't do. They want him to give up even more. They want him to sign a surrender agreement, and he wouldn't. It's not the Palestinians that aren't willing to make concessions. It's Israel that's incapable of making concessions, because concessions on the land are impossible from a Zionist perspective. The whole name of the game is taking the land and making it ours. And this is exactly the process that took place. Please. Now, once again, like I said, the book goes in and out of my own personal family's history and the history of the State of Israel and how the two are related. This is a picture of my niece, Madar. And on September the 4th, 1997, she was killed. Two young Palestinians blew themselves up in Jerusalem, took their own lives, and several Israeli, the lives of several Israelis, including her. She was 13 years old. So when a 13-year-old little girl that you know and love gets killed like this, you know, you don't really know what to do. You don't know what to think. You don't know what to feel. You don't know how you're going to get back to life after that. Now, she was a granddaughter of a famous general. So this was big news. On top of that, she was also the granddaughter of Mr. Peace with Palestine. And now look what they did to him. Look what they did to his granddaughter. My father had already passed away by then. So this was big news. And when I landed and when I arrived in Jerusalem, my sister's house, on the ground, I saw the morning paper, and on the front page it already said the granddaughter of General Peled was killed by Palestinians. And my sister's apartment was packed with mourners, of course, people who came to express their sorrow, but also reporters, endless stream of reporters. And when, after the funeral, she came out to greet and see everybody. She said two things that put me on a path, and I think it put her on a path, and many of us, kind of helped us to wrap our heads around this unspeakable tragedy. The first thing she was asked, of course, is about revenge and retaliation. And the comment that she made was, no real mother would want this to happen to another mother. Don't talk to me about revenge. Motherhood is a uniting force. It cuts through religion. It cuts through any differences that might exist between us. And if she's anything above all, is she is a mother. She's got three other boys, wonderful boys. And the second thing she said was, my government is responsible. My government brought these two young men to such a level of despair that they would take their own lives and take the lives of other innocent people, including a 13-year-old girl. The brutal oppression under which the Palestinians have to live because of us is the cause of this. That is why this is happening. If we want this to happen, we have to lift the oppression. As long as Palestinians are denied hope, and denied freedom, and denied water, and denied their land and their homes, this will continue to happen. I point a finger at my own government. And interestingly enough, Bibi Netanyahu, who's today prime minister, was prime minister then as well. He also used to be a close personal friend of my sister because they went to school together in Jerusalem. That's a whole other side story. So then I came back, you know, the 7 days of mourning that we Jews, we're over, and I had to come back. I lived here in America already, and you have to go to work the next day. And how do you do this? But somehow what my sister said put me on a path, and I decided, okay, it's time to do something. Because she became very outspoken. And her husband, Rami, became very outspoken. Some of you, I think, know, some of you heard him here. About the need for reconciliation and the need to allow the Palestinians their rights and freedoms. I was lucky enough that in San Diego, I met a group of people. It was a Jewish-Palestinian dialogue group. It took me some time to find them, and it took me some time to understand what I was going to do. And what was interesting was, I was 39 years old. I was here in the United States. And that was the very first time I ever met Palestinians. I grew up in Jerusalem. I was born and raised in Jerusalem, a mixed city. The first time I ever sat with Palestinians in a normal setting as completely equal people was here in the United States. Because even though Jerusalem is, you know, so-called united and so on, it's completely segregated. So an Israeli boy does not meet Palestinians. I mean, you might see them doing landscaping or, you know, washing dishes. And then I began hearing all these stories that I'd never heard before. This was a dialogue group, so it was not about, you know, accusing or arguing. Everybody told their story. And I'm sitting with Palestinians and they're telling me about forced exile and about massacres and all these things that we don't do. We Israelis don't do these things. We're a moral people, we're a moral army, we've made mistakes, we're not perfect, but basically we don't do these things. And my good fortune was that I was around a group of people, mostly Palestinians, who helped me go through this transformation. It's like learning, I don't know, it's like having your teeth pulled out without anesthesia. It's so painful. You suddenly learn that everything you know is not true. And coming from my background with my family history, that was very painful. But they were very gracious and very generous in the way they kind of led me through this. And I'm, you know, I'm forever grateful to that Palestinian community in San Diego for, you know, carrying me along. It took several years. The way now I talk about it, like it was easy, but it was very difficult and it took a very long time. And then I became active. And then I started visiting Palestinian communities inside Israel, and I would visit the West Bank. And I began learning more and more about the issue. Do you have the next one, please? And as I traveled to the West Bank, I would see this. If you've been to Qalandia or any of the major checkpoints, you see the sign. It's about the size of one of these walls. It's a massive sign. And as you can see, it's white letters over a red background, which usually means danger. And of course, it's in Hebrew. And what the sign says is that this road leads to Area A, which is under Palestinian control. And entry to Israelis into Area A is forbidden. It's life-threatening. And it's a felony. And if you notice, there are two exclamation marks. So if you're not scared yet, the two exclamation marks will probably do the trick. Now you'll also notice that unless you can read Hebrew, this is irrelevant. It's only true if you can read Hebrew. Now, if you see a sign like that, and you have any sense at all, you turn around and go home. Who in his right mind would see a sign that says danger, firing zone, and walk right into it? My good fortune was that I don't have that kind of sense, and that I have many friends who don't have that kind of sense, and we went right through. And I've been going right through these checkpoints and right through that sign every single time I go visit my friends on the other side of the wall. And what's interesting is I always see the same thing. From the very first time all the way to today, it's been several years, every time I cross that wall, every time I cross the sign, I see the exact same thing. I see traffic jams. I see children going to school, which is probably the most common sight in Palestinian areas, is children coming and going to school. I see people going to work. I see shops. I've yet to see the Palestinians that want to kill me. I've yet to see the Palestinians ready with machine guns and tanks and F-16s ready to bomb me because I'm an Israeli. I've yet to see that. And I know that many other Israelis who do this haven't seen it either. And with time, I began to realize this sign has nothing to do with security. The wall has nothing to do with security. The massive armed Israeli forces along the road have nothing to do with security. The terrorizing and harassment that Palestinian Israelis go through when they go through Tel Aviv Airport, the humiliating process that they have to go through, they have to endure every time they decide to leave and go overseas, has nothing to do with security. It has everything to do with racism, with hatred, and with a deep desire to keep us apart, to keep me privileged and them with no rights. That's the name of the game. That's what it's all about. And that's the purpose of the sign. Can you hit the next one, please? Can you read that? Can somebody read that for me?
United Nations Resolution 3015 from 1973 states, "The struggles of peoples under colonial and alien domination and racist regimes for the implementation of their right to self-determination and independence is legitimate and full of rules of international law.
Legitimate and in full accordance with the principle of international law. This describes the Palestinian struggle. Because that is exactly what Israel is. Now in this picture I stand with my friend Jamal, who sat in Israeli prison for many, many years. In fact, he was given a life sentence, but he was exchanged in one of the prisoner exchanges between Israel and the PLO. And the reason he was given a life sentence is because he killed a soldier. He and three others saw two young Israeli soldiers guarding a bank in Ramallah, of all things. And soldiers are usually fully armed, of course. And they approached them and they stabbed them to death with a knife. And for that, they were later on, you know, beaten, tortured, and arrested and given life sentences. But when I see the picture of the two of us standing side by side, I have to wonder which one of us is really the terrorist. Because according to this, it's certainly not him. I, on the other hand, served in the Israeli army, an army of occupation, an army of oppression, an army whose sole purpose is to make sure that he does not have a state, he does not have rights, and he dare not resist. So yes, my army has uniforms and commanders and generals, but which one of us is really the terrorist? And finally, and this is also how the book ends, what do we do? I mean, how do two nations share a state? How do they share a country? Well, there are lots of examples. Look at Switzerland. Look at Belgium. You know, these are multinational states. The Swiss are Swiss, the Belgians are Belgians, regardless of what, you know, actual nationality they are beyond that. So there are plenty of examples of states that have multinational nations within them. Once again, going back to this question, is one state the right thing? Is two states the right thing? Are three states the right thing? Somebody gave me something, you know, about a confederation. The reality is that Israel had created a one state. The borders, in terms of what, from Israeli perspective, are very clear. The borders of the state of Israel are the Jordan River on the east and the Mediterranean on the west. That's it. If you look at Israeli school books, if you look at weather maps, if you look at any official maps of the state of Israel, it is absolutely clear. There is no question in anybody's mind what the borders of the state of Israel are. That's it. So the notion that there could be an Israeli government that would give up some of that is absolutely absurd. And Israel governs this one state very skillfully with three different sets of laws. You have the laws that govern people like myself, Israeli Jews, who can come and go and say what they please. Pretty much a democratic state for all purposes. You've got the laws that govern the Palestinians who are citizens of Israel, and there are over 30 laws in the law books that discriminate them against them specifically, and you've got an entire culture of discrimination against them that is deep-seated and deep-rooted in Israeli society. And then you've got the laws that govern the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, and this is really at the pleasure of the Israeli army. If they want to destroy, they destroy. If they want to arrest and beat, they arrest and beat. If they want to torture, they torture. If they want to kill, they kill. And Palestinians have no recourse. This is the reality. There's an education system, the Zionist education system, like Judith alluded, my sister just wrote a book about it. She's an educator, that teaches racism in a very subtle way. There's a bureaucracy, an entire bureaucracy, that is dedicated to making life impossible for Palestinians through all kinds of restrictions and permits and requirements that are absolutely uncalled for and unnecessary, but are all given and provided under the guise of security. And then you've got the Israeli army, which I like to refer to as one of the best trained, best equipped, best fed terrorist organizations in the world. And yes, they have generals and they have nice uniforms, but their entire purpose is terrorism. And just as one example, I'll give you one example. Almost exactly 4 years ago, as Israel began its attack on Gaza, September the 27th, 2008, at 11:25 in the morning, what I refer to as the most shameful day in the Jewish history, the most shameful day in the history of the Jewish people. Israel began carpet bombing Gaza, and on the first day of what was to be a 21-day attack, they dropped 100 tons of bombs. Okay, a one-ton bomb will decimate an entire city block. Gaza is one of the most densely populated places in the world. 800,000 children live in Gaza. 11:25 is exactly the time when the morning school shift and the afternoon school shift change. So all the kids are in the streets. All the children are on the streets. That was the moment decided by the decision makers in Israel to begin the attack. This was the first day of a 21-day slaughter that had absolutely no justification. If that's not terrorism, I don't know what is. And this is how the state of Israel manages to control the different populations and somehow still keep up this very sweet liberal kind of face to everything. But we still have to figure out how we go from here. Well, let's look at what happened in South Africa. They got rid of apartheid. That is the example. What did they do in America? They had got rid of the racist laws that existed in the South. Did the whites in South Africa want this, like this? Absolutely not. Did the whites in the southern states in America, here in the United States, want this or like this? No. It was not done by consensus. But Zionism, just like racism, has to go. The Zionist state... The Zionist state has to be replaced with a democracy. Equal rights. We have 5.5 million Palestinians, about 6.5 million Israelis. There's absolutely no reason in the world why they can't live together as equals. Now, often when Jewish people hear this, especially if they support Zionism and support the state of Israel, they go, see, you're talking about genocide. You're talking about another Holocaust. That's just an excuse. There's no reason to assume this is going to be violent. There's no reason for a transfer of power to be violent. Evil dictatorships can be, and evil regimes can be replaced by democracies without violence. It's happened before, there's no reason why it won't happen again. I just heard this thing today about the vast differences between Israelis and Palestinians, cultural differences, the cultural superiority of the Israelis. I've never heard such nonsense in my life. The two societies could not be more similar. Their languages are similar, their religions are similar. More than half of all Israelis are descendants of people who came from the Middle East. They're descendants of Arab Jews who came from Iraq, who came from North Africa, who came from Yemen. Arab culture is part of who they are. When Baghdad was being bombed, you had old Arab Jews from Baghdad in Israel crying that their city is being bombed. There are no differences. And the likelihood of both populations seeing their common cause and seeing their common goals as outweighing any differences that might exist between them is far greater than anything else. And then young Palestinians and young Israelis can grow up and have a future and live in a real democracy and do great things, because this is a beautiful country. And it's a lot of possibilities. So the name of the game has to be democracy and equal rights, not anything else. All right, thank you all very much.
The first one was, is the sale and purchase of land a viable function, and does it follow the rule of law? I'm assuming that means for Palestinians. And then, does Israel use the right of eminent domain, or is the land seized with no legal process? How strong is the opposition within Israel to what appears to be an impending attack on Iran by Israel? That's three questions, okay?
Let's do one more.
One more, okay. Is Bibi really serious about attacking Iran, or is this a sideshow in order to avoid dealing with the Palestinians?
Okay. I'm saying I'm no legal expert, so I don't really know about this eminent domain and sale of land and so on. So I'm not sure how to. I will say this, and I don't know if it answers the question or not, but in Israel, the land is all owned by the state. So in essence, there's no private property. When you buy land, you're actually leasing it from the state. So, and every 49 years, you have to lease it again for either 50 or either 49 years or 99 years. That's kind of how that works. So what they try to do, like after 1948, they passed a law that meant that all of the absentee property is the property of the people who were thrown out and then left as absentee, is their absence somehow. The law passed that made it permissible for the state to take over the land. Then they passed another law that made it illegal for the Palestinian refugees to return and claim their land. So that's how that works. I don't know if that answers the question, but I'm, like I said, I'm no legal scholar. Is there opposition in Israel to an attack? You know, and is Bibi serious about the attack? The whole Iran issue, in my opinion anyway, is a smokescreen. It was designed very cleverly, and it's used very cleverly by Netanyahu and his government to shift everybody's attention from Palestine to some other fictional threat. And it's been very successful. I mean, the United Nations General Assembly, nobody talks about Palestine. You know, everything was about Iran, the threat on Iran, attack Iran, the bomb Iran, don't bomb Iran. Thousands of political prisoners in violation of international law sit in Israeli prisons. Palestinian children get less water than Israeli children. Palestinians are kicked off their homes and their land is being taken and their towns are being destroyed every single day. People are being killed, shot and killed in nonviolent protests in the West Bank every single week. How can you talk about this nonsense, though, when there's a threat of an Iran the Iranian nuclear threat? And they managed to manipulate this. So I don't think he's serious. I think he would be politically insane to let go of this wonderful card. But as long as he can keep talking about an Iranian threat, people are not going to talk about Palestine. What's the point of attacking Iran? What would that give him? Politically, it gives him nothing. Militarily, it gives him nothing, because there is no threat. And then he's going to have a problem. This way, he's got this issue. He's had it for several years, and I don't think he'll give it up. So I don't think he's serious about it. That's not to say that there is no possibility that something might happen, but I can't imagine that he would do that. And you know, people in Israel are basically scared. I mean, what do people know? People know what they read, what they hear in the paper every day. The headline: somebody says something about Iran. The defense minister decided to say just a few weeks ago. And the defense minister goes back and forth, supporting it and being against it, and supporting it and being against it. And so a few weeks ago, there was a headline saying, quoting him as saying, that the blade that rests on our necks now is even sharper and more dangerous than the threat of 1967. So my first reaction was, he should read my book. But you know, anybody that's knowledgeable knows that there was no threat in 1967, but they want to create this tension that bring back that tension of 1967, where people are actually afraid. Israelis in 1967 were scared to death. The generals didn't let on that this was going to be a very easy war. You know, people were actually afraid that there would be another Holocaust. And they're creating this fear again so that they can continue to talk about this threat. So I don't think it's a real threat, and I don't think Bibi would attack, because it's too good of a political card to give up.
Yeah. Okay. Do you think a one-state solution will work, given that 60 to 70% of Israeli Jews and Israeli Arabs and Palestinians do not favor a one-state solution? How do you make this happen? That's one question, okay?
Okay.
Well, and the second one is similar, so I won't read it. Where did this land-grabbing, this is a biggie, racist Zionist philosophy come from? And where did the suicide bomber phenomenon come from? And...
Whoa, let me write this down.
And how could you live your whole life in Israel, serve in the military, and not see what you now see?
Oh, easy. Okay.
Is that three good ones?
Yeah, that's
okay.
Good. Yeah. Well, I don't know that such a large number of Palestinians don't want the two-state solution. I talk to a lot of Palestinians, and I haven't done any statistics, but a lot of Palestinians that I talk to realize and see no problem with it. So I don't think there's going to be that big of an opposition on the Palestinian side to this at all. There will be opposition, of course, on the Israeli side, because when you're privileged, you don't want to give up your privileges. You know, we, the Israeli Jews, are privileged in this society. And the privileges that are given to us by the state are part of the attempt to set us apart from the Palestinians. So if I break the law in Hebron, and a Palestinian breaks the exact same law in the exact same spot, the laws that govern the state of Israel, which are, you know, regular, you know, conventional law, applies to me. Israeli military law applies to the Palestinian. If I participate, or I should say when I participate in protests in the West Bank and I get arrested, everybody knows how it's going to end. I go home at the end of the day. I might get roughed up a little bit, you know, whatever, but at the end of the day, everybody knows I go home. Because I'm an Israeli Jew. Palestinian that gets arrested will be beaten, will be tortured, and will be kept in prison as long as the local commander wants him in prison. It could be a day, it could be a week, it could be a month, it could be a year, without charges and without a trial. And then 6 months later, I get a letter from the police saying that the case was closed because of something, some technicality. So Israelis are not going to want to give up this privilege, but I think whites in South Africa didn't want to give up their privilege, and whites in America didn't want to give up their privilege either, but they're going to have to. Things like this are not done as a result of a consensus. That's why there are pressures. That's why there's BDS. That's why there's a non-violent resistance. That's why we have events like this. That's why more and more American Jews are breaking away from Zionism and coming and organizing events like this. And whether they like it or not, this is the transformation that's going to take place. People ask me, well, I'll tell you a little story. I was asked, I spoke at an eighth grade class. A friend of mine is a teacher of this really nice, special kind of a school where kids actually learn about stuff. So it's an eighth grade class, and they're learning about this issue. And they've been learning about it for a few weeks, and they wanted me to come and speak. And they took a poll among themselves asking how many of them think there will be a solution in their lifetime, a peaceful solution in their lifetime. These are eighth graders. They're 13 years old. 80% said no. So when I came to speak, I said, well, let's see if I can't change your mind. Because it's all a question of what you know. And I explained to them about the similarities about the societies and all the possibilities that exist once the state of Israel is transformed into a democracy. If I didn't think this was possible in my lifetime, I wouldn't be doing this. If I wasn't completely confident that this is actually going to happen, I wouldn't be doing this. So Israelis aren't going to like it, but they don't need to like it. You know, that's kind of the way these things are. But I think Palestinians, the impression that I have, and I'm there a lot, is that Palestinians actually do favor this. Okay, there's two questions here. One is about where did Zionist philosophy come from? Well, in the turn of the 19th century, there was, you know, this nationalism arose, and all these little groups decided that they were going to become nations. And my grandparents were part of that. They were Jews, and they were in Eastern Europe, and they suffered from pogroms, and they suffered from all kinds of discrimination and racism against Jews and anti-Semitism, and they thought, well, maybe this is a good idea. And when Zionism began, you know, there was a whole scope of Zionisms. You know, there were Zionists that believed in a democracy, that Jews and Arabs would live together. They didn't, in their wildest dreams, imagine that they would kick out people from their homes. And then there were other Zionists who later on became the mainstream Zionists, led by people like Ben-Gurion, who was Israel's first prime minister, that were radical, racist, and violent. And they won the day. And they gave the tone, and that's why Zionism is what it is today. Racist, violent, militant, and non-compromising. But that tone was given by Ben-Gurion and people around him. So that's where that came from. And where did suicide bombers come from? I don't know that suicide bombing is a philosophy. I mean, there are 5.5 million Palestinians who live inside of Palestine. There's probably another five or so that live outside of Palestine. That's 10 million people. There were less than 200 suicide bombers. So it's not like, you know, there's a rash, there's some kind of a madness of suicide bombers among Palestinians. Let's put things in perspective. And I don't know that there's a philosophy to it. I think when people are desperate enough and hopeless enough, they see their fathers being beaten and tortured, they see their sisters being shot and arrested, they see their homes being destroyed, they have no ability to go anywhere or buy food or provide water for their families or their siblings, and they see this massive army that is relentlessly oppressing them and beating them. If there's no hope, there's no hope. So we do what we can, you know. But I think if we actually look at how many people actually did this, and I don't know a single Palestinian, and I know a lot of Palestinians, that thinks this was a good thing or supports it. So I think it's important to put the suicide bombing thing in proportion. Yeah.
Okay, I have four cards here that all kind of deal with something. So it's not really three questions. I'll just give you a whole series of topics. Are you saying that nothing will change unless there are changes in American policies and public opinion? What can we do in our U.S. communities to support a single democratic state in Israel?
Hold on, slow down.
How do we counter...
Hold on.
This is all part... Well, it's
yeah,
all...
Yeah, but I gotta... Yeah.
Oh, you gotta get them? Okay.
So nothing will change unless something changes in the U.S. What can we do?
Yeah, what can we do? Saying that nothing will change unless America...
Okay.
And what can we do in our communities to support a single democratic state and to counter...
No,
what?
That's fine.
Oh, yeah, he wanted me to read them. I tried.
Go on.
How do we counter influence of AIPAC and other Jewish organizations over U.S. policies?
Okay.
And how do we convince Americans, I assume, who speak against Israeli policies to fight the false accusation of anti-Semitism? And what do you see as the U.S. collusion with the current Zionist project, and who's actually calling the shots historically, the Zionist movement or the U.S. government and big business? Those are all related.
Okay. Wow. That's a lot of questions. Okay. Well, nothing's going to change until a lot of things change. I think... Closer? Okay. I think nothing's going to change until a lot of things change. So things have to change in this country, certainly, and they are changing in this country. Like I said, you know, I'm going to be speaking right now. I've booked through Thanksgiving, pretty much straight through. More than half of the events that I'm invited to speak at are organized by American Jews. So I see a very big change in what's perceived to be, you know, American Jewry. It's no longer this blind admiration for AIPAC and for Israel and for the whole Zionist thing. Jews are looking at the state of Israel and they say, well, this does not represent us. This is not what we stand for. Thousands of political prisoners, torture, discrimination. This is not what American Jews stand for. So more and more American Jews are moving away from Zionism, and I think that's a very good thing. So that's changing already. I also think that, you know, certainly the United Methodist, the Presbyterian churches are doing a lot of work on this issue. And they're making big strides, and they're bringing about big changes. And I think the more Americans see Jewish people criticize Israel, the more non-Jewish people will feel comfortable. And this anti-Semitic thing, people ask me this all the time. They say, well, look, you can say this because you are you, but when we say it, they call us anti-Semitic. And my reply to that is, fine. I mean, they call me a self-hating Jew. I just got something that said I was a self-hating Jew or that I hate Jews or something. Fine, I'll take that. Now, let's talk about something else. Can you explain to me why Palestinian children get no water? Can you explain to me how you justify dropping 100 tons of bombs on children? Can you explain to me throwing people out of their homes and making them homeless? Can you explain to me yanking kids out of their beds at 2 o'clock in the morning, throwing them in prison and torturing them? Can you explain all this to me? Perhaps I'm anti-Semitic. Now you explain all this to me. What does that make you? And this has to be the conversation. calling people anti-Semitic is a very weak weapon. It's a very weak tool. It's all they've got. But when you actually look at it, it's completely meaningless because they do not have an answer for all those other questions. And that has to be the issue. They're the ones who have to explain, not anybody, not you, not us. You have nothing to explain. These are legitimate questions. You supported, you danced, you celebrated when Israel was dropping hundreds of tons on bombs on 800,000 children. They were locked up in Gaza and had nowhere to go. You supported this. I'm anti-Semitic? What does that make you? You support a country that deliberately prevents children from access to water, not to mention food and medicine and education and a home and freedom. You support that. What does that make you? How can you support this? This has to be the conversation. And I'm not suggesting it's an easy thing to do, but I am suggesting that this is how you counter AIPAC. And that's what you do here in the US. Because these are the conversations that these are the best excuses, these are the best thing AIPAC can come up with.
Come on.
They're talking about transforming Israel as anti-Semitism and it's calling for genocide. Who's talking about genocide? I haven't heard anybody suggest genocide. Of all the people that I've heard, and I've heard a lot of people talk about this transition, changing Israel from a Zionist state to a democracy. I've heard many people talk about, Ilan Pape who talks about it, and many people talk about this. None of them, not a single one of them, would support a violent transition. Not one would support violence. And violence is not needed. So that's how you combat AIPAC, and that's how you counter AIPAC, and that's how you convince Americans not to be afraid. Like I said, I'm not suggesting it's easy. When somebody comes back with this anti-Semitism thing, then people, you know, pull back and they're afraid. And I can understand that. It's very hurtful. At the same time, there's a bigger issue here. So this may hurt our feelings for 5 seconds, but, you know, let's continue the conversation. And that's what has to happen. And that's how you take over this AIPAC nonsense. The collision with Zionism is inevitable. Was it collision or collusion? Huh? Oh, collusion, I'm sorry. Well, I think it's temporary. It's temporary. I mean, America does, you know, politicians in America do what they have to do in order to get elected. Being pro-Zionist is part of what you have to do in America if you want a political career. Either you're the president or a council member of, you know, like my city, Coronado. I mean, they're not even, you know, it's kind of a part-time job. That's the name of the game. That's the price of doing business. So I think the president cares more about healthcare than about Israel. So he's going to give money to Israel so they shut up and he can pass healthcare reform. This is how it is. This is politics in America. And that's why a second Obama term is not going to make the difference, any change. It's not going to be different on this issue. Because he doesn't care enough and because, you know, why bother? He's got nothing to gain. But it's going to start from the bottom. And once there's a lot going on, it's like I said to somebody earlier, it's like Vietnam. When American people decided enough is enough, Congress said enough is enough, and the president said enough, and that was it. And Americans were out of Vietnam. But it takes that kind of a movement. And right now, it's true that on this issue, Israel calls the shots. Right now, when Israel says jump, but the American politicians say how high? And then they move on to the next thing. But that's the price of doing business here in America if you want to be a politician. Is that it?
I have one more question. How has your book been received in Israel?
It hasn't been received in Israel. I don't think anybody in Israel read it. You know, I've had several speaking events and I've had a couple of book launches, but they were all on the other side. One was in East Jerusalem, one was in Ramallah, and so on. And so Israel ignores this completely, and that may change. I don't know. But I haven't had any response one way or the other from anybody in Israel about the book. That's it?
Yeah, that is it for questions. It is not it for signing books.
Okay, folks. There you have it. There you have this talk by Mr. Miko Peled, who now resides in Southern California with his family. And let me just give you a few more details about this man and his talk. This what you heard is available on the YouTube website under the main title is simply "An Honest Israeli Jew Tells the Real Truth About Israel." Also on the poster for the talk, "Why the Son of an Israeli General, Army General, is Speaking Out for Palestine." Miko Pellid is from a famous and influential Israeli Zionist family and was born in Jerusalem. Miko's father was a famous general in the army, the Israeli army. Miko, too, has served his time there. And by the way, this was added to YouTube's site on December 2nd, 2012, just over 3 years ago. I saw and heard him speak a couple of years ago here in Santa Cruz, California. A few more details. I want to take a close look at something here. Okay, it seems to be recording my voice. This too was published on December 2nd of 12. Miko too has served his time in the Israeli army. When his niece was killed in a Palestinian suicide bomb attack, as was mentioned in Pellid's talk, his family surprisingly placed the blame squarely on the State of Israel. They believed it was the torture, violence, and forced eviction from their homes that was driving Palestinians to commit suicide to fight back. An Israeli Jewish citizen and mother. In this honest, groundbreaking talk, Pellid reveals the truth about the terror state of Israel. The terror state of Israel. His talk is based on his father's insider knowledge on the Israeli War of Terror, coupled with his own research, with Miko Pellid's research, the son. Many Jews in Israel supporters will be deeply shaken by this expose. Some facts from his talk are that the returning Jews are not the original expelled Jews, nor their descendants. He also reveals that until 1947, when Israel launched their illegal terrorist attacks on the people of Palestine, there was no conflict. Obviously, what I'm reading here is a bit of a synopsis of the audio from his talk that you just heard. Continuing, Miko Pellid is one of many modern-day Jews who are standing up to the Zionist State of Israel. This talk is a must-watch for everybody, or a must-listen in this case. Again, it's available on YouTube. A must-watch to clear their minds of the lies spread and supported by the Zionist-owned mainstream media. Pretty controversial stuff there. Uploaded by the website MuslimsAndTheWorld.com. Original clip is located there too. And again, the title of the video and its accompanying audio track is simply "An Honest," just go to YouTube and type in the whole thing or something close to "An Honest Israeli Jew Tells the Real Truth About Israel." This is the Mideast Migraine Show, coming to you by way of Free Radio Santa Cruz. We broadcast to the city of Santa Cruz, California, at 101.3 on the FM dial, and we're streaming. One of these days we'll be streaming live again at freakradio.org, freakradio.org. Going to give you a little more Miko Pellid here. I mean, like, why not? Since he is a topic of immediate concern, I will be reading from his first book. I believe it's his very first book, which is entitled "The General's Son, An Israeli Jew's Journey into Palestine." This is from the American Herald Tribune. November 26 of this year, just last month, November 26, written by Miko Peled. Lies and violence, comma, the essence of the Israeli narrative. There is another interview with him that I did play, perhaps a year or so ago on my program. This is the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz. And Peled was really getting down and dirty about his, what he really believes to be the case in terms of control of the nation of his birth, Israel, and what Zionism is really all about. You can feel and hear the disgust and, frankly, the anger in his voice in that interview. I'm sure that interview is in my archives, which are located at the alternative website, radioforall.net. That's R-E-D-I-O, the number 4, A-L-L.net, radioforall.net. Simply go to that website and type in Mideast Migraines and do a search on Miko Peled. You'll come up with at least a couple of programs prior to this one. Okay, let's read this article from a couple of weeks ago in the American Herald Tribune. Lies and Violence, the Essence of the Israeli Narrative, by Miko Peled himself. Whether discussing the ethnic cleansing of Palestine in 1948, the murder of thousands in Gaza in the summer of 2014, or the racism and terror to which Palestinians have been subjected by Israel for 7 decades, Israelis are resolved to claim that they hold the moral high ground. Whenever the Israeli narrative and Israeli legitimacy are brought into question, Israelis react with panic or violence or both. From accusations of anti-Semitism and support for terrorism, to attacks on one's credibility or even the actual bombing and killing of thousands in Gaza, this is the range of reactions from Israelis to the possibility that the Zionist narrative is flawed, not to say a blatant lie. Some will say we must not generalize. It is not the people. It is the leaders who are at fault. But this too is a lie. Israel's leaders were elected by the people, and on the same issue of Palestine, and on the issue of Palestine, there is no opposition. Israeli claims to the legitimacy of its existence and the legitimacy of its genocidal policies toward Palestinians rest on shaky ground. Palestinians are not being killed because they pose a threat to Israeli security. Anyone with half a brain can see that they have never posed a threat to Israel, not even in the slightest way. But Palestinians do pose a serious threat to the legitimacy of Israel, and this means that it is very tough to argue the case for Israel in front of a critical audience without being embarrassed. A recent piece in the Electronic Intifada, Ali Abunima describes an incident which led students at the University of Texas at Austin to call for a professor to be investigated for assaulting a group of students who were staging a protest on campus. The incident occurred just before a lecture given by Stanford University historian Gil Lee Vardy about the Israeli military as an, and I quote, offensive, daring, highly effective, and initiative-driven army, end quote. Well, that statement right there ought to piss off just about anyone. Incidentally, he doesn't spell out piss off. He just says capital P, capital O. Continuing, there is a video that shows the students, members of the Palestine Solidarity Committee, attempting to make a protest statement, and Professor Ami Padazur, director of the Institute for Israel Studies, aggressively confronting them, at one point pushing his face up to one of the students, clearly threatening them physically. At one point, another man is seen as he proceeds to rip a Palestinian flag from the hands of one of the students. According to the piece in EI, Electronic Intifada, the man who grabbed the flag is James Hussick, a weapons industry contractor, graduate student at the University of Texas, and fellow at the Atlantic Council. Oh, hello, Tiffany. You want to watch Daddy as he records his program here? Mm-hmm. Tiffany says hi to you all. Okay. Sit here calmly. Continuing now. Where did I leave off? I'm not the only one who does a radio program with this cat in the room. Let's start this paragraph again. I'll end the paragraph that I was reading. According to the piece in Electronic Intifada, the man who grabbed the flag is James Hussick, a weapons industry contractor, graduate student at the University of Texas, and fellow at the Atlantic Council. These professors behave exactly like Israeli soldiers and settlers who regularly try to intimidate Palestinians in an attempt to silence them. Remember, folks, this is written by a man who is a native Israeli Jew born in Jerusalem. Son of an Israeli war hero. Can't say that enough to help qualify his qualifications. This is the way that Miko Peled feels now. New paragraph. The Israeli narrative, like the Holy Grail, must be protected everywhere and at all cost. It is what defines us as Israelis. Without it, we have no identity, and what's worse, no legitimacy. In Palestine or Austin, Texas, it is our duty as Israelis to confront anyone who dares to question it. The narrative begins with us, the Jewish people being the descendants of the ancient Hebrews, who lived somewhere within the boundaries of today's Palestine some 3,000 years ago. Though, as I look at my features and those of my immediate ancestors, I see nothing that resembles dwellers of any country of the Levant. But that's of little importance at this point. We were forced into exile by the Assyrians, then the Babylonians, and finally by the Romans, but now, over 2,000 years later, we have returned to claim our country back. A bit of the old tongue-in-cheek as he gives this wording of his description of the Israeli narrative and its supposed legitimacy. Continuing. Being that we are good people, we accepted United Nations Resolution 181 that called for the partition of Palestine and allowed for some of our land, as it says here, to be allotted for the Arabs of Israel. The Arabs, being anti-Semitic by nature, attacked us, even as we were struggling to establish a fledgling state for Jews. And thankfully, being that we are the descendants of King David, who defeated Goliath, and descendants of the Maccabees, who defeated great empires, we defeated the Arabs. Having defeated them and being the compassionate people that we are, we begged, in fact, the Arabs of Israel to remain. Yet they got up and left. Hundreds of thousands of Arabs left their homes, their land, and walked away into the sunset. This mass migration was described by so many Zionist leaders, all of whom were secular and non-believers, parenthetically, is nothing short of a miracle. Thus, we, the Jewish people, were able to establish a Jewish majority on our land and a state for the Jews in the land of Israel. After 2,000 years in exile, and only a few short years after the Holocaust. A pretty powerful narrative. Whenever Israelis participate in dialogue groups, peace camps, and other such normalization activities, the one topic that cannot be discussed is the Palestinian narrative of 1948. Again, the one topic that cannot be discussed is the Palestinian narrative of 1948. No questions regarding the legitimacy of Israel and the crimes of Zionists committed in 1948 are permitted. The argument is that since the past cannot be undone, why bring it up? We must focus on the future. The problem is that we cannot create a future unless we discuss the past. And although the past cannot be undone, justice can be executed, remedies and restitution for crimes that were committed can be established. In fact, they must be. But this is why Israelis of all walks of life feel they have the right, indeed a duty, to defend the narrative, defend the Holy Grail, like the Knights of the Round Table. But there is nothing chivalrous about the behavior of Israelis. Maintaining almost seven decades of a ruthless apartheid regime is not chivalrous. It is Sparta. The violence and abuse and legal discrimination that Palestinians had to endure over the last seven decades and continue to endure today are precisely the reason why Israelis feel the need to preempt the question of its legitimacy with violence. Where was I? Okay. Continuing, why is the Palestinian question not resolved? Why are the refugees not permitted to return? Why is the Gaza Strip under siege and regularly attacked with such vicious force? Why are thousands of Palestinians held in Israeli jails? Why are Israeli soldiers and armed vigilantes, read settlers, I inserted that, permitted to murder Palestinians with impunity? Israel is faced with two choices. End the occupation of Palestine, free the prisoners, end the siege of Gaza, allow the refugees to return, and pay restitution. But Israel doesn't want to do that. So the only other option is to bomb and kill the Palestinians and blame them for being terrorists, untrustworthy and incapable of living in peace with others. I'm going to read that sentence again. Listen closely and think. So the only other option is to bomb and kill the Palestinians and blame them for being terrorists, unworthy and incapable of living in peace with others. You know, they're the ones who are being bombed and decimated and genocided. Continuing, it just so happens that as we discuss yet one more failed attempt to silence the Palestinian voice at the University of Texas at Austin, the Palestinian poet Rafif Ziadah just released a new album of her poems called We Teach Life. In one of the poems she so beautifully recites, named If My Words Can Stop This, she says, if my words can stop this, if they can stand in the way of a bomb, a drone, or a bullet, I would lay them at the feet of every child in Gaza and offer them like prayer. I would recite them over and over and over like the holy names of God. I would write them endlessly until all language breaks. But words can't stop this. So I offer you the silence. But her poems offer no silence, Peled continues here. Sharp as a razor, they cut deeply and awaken us to feel for a moment that which Palestinians endure with such courage and dignity their entire lives. And hard as they try, no professor or soldier or settler will ever be able to silence her voice, or the voices of Palestinian students on campuses, or the voices of Palestinians in the villages and the refugee camps. No amount of violence or lies can silence this truth. Miko Peled. And again, I'll read these biographical synopsis attached to this article. Miko Peled is an Israeli writer and activist living in the U.S. He was born and raised in Jerusalem. His father was the late Israeli General Mati Peled, driven by a personal family tragedy to explore Palestine, its people, and their narrative. He has written a book about his journey from the sphere of the privileged Israeli to that of the oppressed Palestinians. His book is titled The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. That's the proper wording. The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. That's what I'll be reading starting next Saturday. Peled speaks nationally and internationally on the issue of Palestine. Peled supports the creation of a single democratic state in all of Palestine. He is also a firm supporter of boycott, divestment, and sanctions of Israeli cultural, academic, and economic life. BDS. Those of you who maybe may have listened to my programs in the past will know that, particularly on the Monday edition, 3 o'clock p.m. Pacific time, Pacific Standard Time, that Monday program offers more and more slightly widening variety of topics, many of which are more loosely based on the Palestine-Israel conflict, and some of which may have absolutely nothing to do with any of that. You know, as a single free radio programmer, I have, as you might imagine, virtually endless material that I could read off over the air. And I've come to realize that realistically, the market, as it were, for that kind of thing, and that 2 hours per show worth of beating people over the head with that, is pretty slim. I'm sure that people, wherever they are, here in famously weird Santa Cruz, California, Berkeley, other parts of the Bay Area where this program is known to be distributed to some degree, or anywhere in the world where you've got internet, some people will gobble up what I have to say. But an awful lot of people, frankly, would be put to sleep or become so irate at my supposed anti-Semitism, supposed hatred of Israel, neither of those is the case, that they'll just turn me right off. So be assured that my editorial stance will continue to broaden and ultimately touch upon other areas, certainly at the general topic of misinformation and lies my government told me, lies my parents told me, whether or not they were lied to about those things from their parents and their benefactors. I do want to get more into talking about the nature of disinformation. The only problem, of course, is, as you may well imagine, try looking up information about disinformation on the internet or even going to the library. Probably not a whole lot of titles about that. And of course, given the nature of the topic, anything you do look at will have to be very carefully vetted and determined to the best of one's ability to be trustworthy and worthy of transmission on the program. So that's a statement about what I will continue to be about, to try to be about. And as this, the son of a native Jerusalemite himself, my father being from a Christian family and having raised his son and 4 daughters, along with his American wife, in the Lutheran Church, American Lutheran Church here in California, I was born in San Francisco, where my father ended up a de facto exiled expatriate because he He happened to be out of his native Palestine in May of 48 when Israel came into being, and lo and behold, discovered that he wasn't going to be able to return, simply because Israel canceled his British Foreign Office issued passport, disallowing him to return. Believe it or not, there are estimated to be some 60,000 Palestinians who were outside of their country who were similarly affected, which is to say, virtually none of them were able to come back. Most likely, virtually none of them were able to return to their homes. My dad lost his home, his property. At least two members of his family, including his older business partner brother, Wadia, who was killed by Zionists, and their cousin out in the country in what is now called the West Bank, or Free Palestine, if you will, who was beaten to death by another group of Zionist, armed Zionist zealots. So this is what I mean when I say I'm a Palestinian American. I did have the good fortune to visit the Gaza Strip back in 2008. As I have let people who listen to this program know time and time again, and for a very short visit. We were extremely lucky to get in, as it turned out. Whole nother story there. So, again, that's where I'm coming from and why I refer to myself as a Palestinian American, and not more generically simply an Arab American. I'm going to give the rest of this program a rest now. I know that it's only some less than 45 minutes long today, but let me remind everyone, I'll be returning for the full two-hour show next Saturday, when I will begin the reading of Michael Peled's The General's Son, An Israeli's Journey into Palestine. That was published all probably around the time of the recorded lecture that you heard today on this show, 2012, latter half of 2012. I'll let you know for sure when I find my copy of the book to read to you next Saturday, December 19th at 11 a.m. Pacific time. I really have to put this sucker to bed here, so I have it up and running for you in the morning. Thank you for joining me, and it's very happy to be producing brand new shows again. Thank you, and I'm gonna adopt a new sign-off signature saying, which I've stolen from someone from the station decades ago. Do what you can, but behave yourself.